once more under the breach, dear friends.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and...
Jeff
McClure. We're here to talk to you about all things economic, but before we start talking about that dismal and dreary science, we have something even more dismal and dreary: disclosures. The two people speaking to you right now, this is the most important disclosure you may hear all day, they are bald. Mm. They are also bearded. Mm. If this causes triggering in you for some reason, you are invited to please switch to a different station or turn off the podcast.
Or consult with a qualified counselor.
Yes, immediately. A second set of disclosures, although these are on a scale of impact to you, probably not as important as the others. The program you're listening to is The Personal Wealth Coach. The name Personal Wealth Coach, or The Personal Wealth Coach, is also the name of an investment advisory firm registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission to give fiduciary investment advice. Just because it's registered and it's sort of the same people talking on here that do the firm and back and forth doesn't mean, number one, that the SEC thinks that we're any better than anybody else. In fact, they just know how to find us. What it does mean is that we have some tighter regulation on what we're allowed to say and not say. So to be very clear on that, registered to give fiduciary advice, which we cannot give on the air. So inside of everything that we do, fiduciary, find the best thing for the client. We can't do that on the air, but we can teach you stuff. So this is education, not advice. If it were advice, we'd actually have to be one-on-one or two-on-one or some other version of wrestling where we were sitting together with some degree of privacy and talking to you about your individualized stuff. And I'm not even sure anybody's listening to it. Well, yep, somebody's listening. Philip, thank you for listening. He told me we need to bring it today. Yeah, nothing like putting the pressure on, guys.
What are we bringing?
I'm bringing spaghetti. What do you have in mind?
Well, I normally try to eat meat.
All right. So steak and spaghetti. We're going to bring it today. We're not giving advice. We're giving education. We're registered with the SEC, but they don't give us any kind of approval or thumbs up or anything else. We're bald, we're bearded. You've got one you want to throw in there. There's another important disclosure in here.
Well, the information we provide on this educational radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information.
Or unsaid information, for that matter, because give full guarantee and warranty that it is incomplete.
I will warrant that all unsaid information is unsaid.
FOB Detroit. Sorry. I had to finish that up. Okay. And the very, very last thing before we start talking 10 minutes into the hour about actually what we're here to talk about is that we're not paying for this radio spot. This is not paid commercial programming. We don't pay the station and they don't pay us. We've been doing this program for free for a long time. I'm coming up on 25 years now. In February, I'll have been doing this program with you for 25 years.
And I think I did it for a year before you came on board. Yeah. So it'd be, I think it's around 26 years we've been doing this.
So that's a long time to not get paid for Saturday mornings. So that's all right. We're okay with that. I'm just... This is the equivalent of humble bragging in that we're saying, we're martyrs, but we're fine. We're fine. I assure you. Okay. So why are we doing it for free? I get that question. Because there's nothing out there that helps people understand what's going on. If you read the Wall Street Journal, most of what you read, you don't know what it means. So this is kind of our give back. We do get some clients out of this, and this studio advertises for us, and we advertise for, or advertises for this radio program, and we pay money to advertise for the radio program as well. So, Senator, there is no quid pro quo, or any other Latin word, especially not bad ones.
Right.
Right. Okay, so what happened this week in the market?
It went up. Anything, do you need to know anything else?
The market went up?
The
Is that inflation or what happened there? What?
The United States stock market.
It gained elevation.
We use the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index.
As our rough outline.
As our main indicator. We have two indicators we use for the market, but that's the main indicator we use because A, it's the oldest, and B, it's fairly widely reported. Well, you've got records on the S&P 500, whether you can argue about whether they're accurate or not, that go back into the 1800s, whereas the Dow Jones Industrial Average started early in this century,
right.
Or last century. I'm in the wrong century.
Is
that an understatement? Anyway, we use the S&P 500 index, and technically I always put in here SPX. Why? Because there's actually several ways of measuring the S&P 500 index, which is a universal truth about darn nearly everything economic. There are multiple ways to measure it.
Yes.
And as a result, if the SPX measurement is a very specific, it's called the price index. It doesn't include dividends, and I know that sounds goofy, but anyway.
It all sounds goofy. We are in the esoteric frame of mind about conceptual nothings, but it all means something to us somehow.
Yes. Well, the SPX, the S&P 500 stock index, rose 1.45% for its first week of the year. And it was, since the new year occurred on a weekend, it was indeed a full week, and it rose 1.45%. Now, this would be interesting. Let's annualize that.
No.
We have a 75% rise in the S&P 500
Realistic. That's not realistic.
Okay. It'd be nice.
I mean, but for some reason, I don't think every week of the year is going to be like the first week of the year.
Well, you could multiply 1.45% 52 times.
Yeah.
And see what comes out.
It's a very, very large amount. And yeah.
Yeah, but when the GDP is released each quarter, they don't tell you how much the gross domestic product rose in a quarter. When the monthly inflation is released,
they give it annualized.
Or quarterly inflation, they give it as if it was for the full year.
Yeah.
Why not just go ahead and do that with the stock market?
That wouldn't work. None of it works, actually.
And I actually want to talk about that a little bit later on, about the fact that we have a very distorted view of inflation.
Yes.
Because it's annualized.
And not just annualized, but annualized for 1 year ago, rather than what's happening at this moment. We're comparing to what's happened in the last year.
Right.
Which
and we're
means
treating
you,
it if you look like at that, a current event.
Right. If you look at that number, you can't tell what's happened recently. That could have all happened at the beginning of that 12-month period.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, back to the market.
The S&P 500 rose 1.45%. It closed out the week at 3895.08. Now, we go over that number, and who pays any attention to that number? Actually, there's a good thing to look at here. It's getting close to 4,000 again, and psychologically, 4,000 on the S&P 500 is an important number. 4,000, if it gets to 4,000 again and stays above 4,000, it will be above some moving averages that traditionally have indicated that the bear market is effectively over. It hasn't gotten back up to where it was before it started down again at the beginning of last year. As a matter of fact, it's the year to date, by the way, is 1.45%. The week is 1.45%. So we had a year to date performance in 1 week. Of course, it was the first week of the year, so that makes it interesting. Anyway, it is down 16.72% from where it was a year ago, which was at the beginning of last year, which is the same as the year. Anyway, it is up almost 8.72% from the low on October 12th. It's up 74% from March of 2020 when we had the bottom of the COVID downturn, and it's up about 19%. In a three-year period. Why do I put all those numbers in there? Because if you are investing rather than speculating, and I don't think we have a lot of speculators who listen to us on the radio because we're not speculators, a 19% return, not counting dividends, over the last 3 years is darn good. So if you are truly an investor and you're looking at a three-year trailing return right now, the market is distinctly up. If you are looking at 1 year, which makes you a form of speculator, the market is down. And that's the thing to keep your eye on if you're a long-term investor, is not the short-term returns, but the long-term returns. We follow another index, the CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index, which, why do we follow that? The S&P 500, and for that matter, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, are composed of very large companies with very large valuations of stock traded. And they tend, particularly the S&P 500, tends to be dominated by growth-oriented companies where investors are, in essence, betting that the future earnings of these companies will be higher than their current earnings, and they don't care what the underlying company is worth. The value side of the market is the side where stocks are priced primarily according to their intrinsic value, as if you would break the company up and sell it. How much would people pay for it? And you divide that number by the number of shares out there. If it's below that number, then it's a value stock. That's rough, but it's close enough. So the mid-cap value aren't large companies. They're mid-cap, mid-sized companies. And they are not growth-oriented. They're value-oriented. So their price is based on their underlying value. And so let's talk about that index. The CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index ended the week at 2412.07. It was up 3.10% in the first week, almost double what the S&P 500, well, it was over double what the S&P 500 did. It is only down 7% from its high at the beginning of 2022. And that is a fundamental change in the way the market is working right now. For a long time, growth, for the last 10 years, basically, growth has dominated the market. Over the very long term, academic studies have strongly suggested that value stocks will outperform growth stocks.
Yeah, growth stocks are like the startups, the ones that are being fed loaned money or venture capital, which is in essence loaned money that's going to get yanked back at some point.
Well, Microsoft is a growth stock.
Right.
Tesla is a growth stock, and they're not exactly startups.
No, but they are considered growth stocks because the area that they are growing in is startups. So Microsoft's big push right now is in cloud computing. Same with Amazon. Amazon makes more profit from the cloud computing side than from the other side. So that doesn't mean they have more revenue, more profit. Mm-hmm. The majority of their profit is now coming from hosting stuff on the web rather than selling stuff to you and having it delivered. The overhead on delivery is higher. It's profitable, but not as profitable as the other side of the business. So that's a startup side, and they took a lot of loans to do that with. And when you see Microsoft laying people off, it's because they're using loans to do the startup side of what they're doing, the research side of what they're doing. And that's why they're a growth company, or it's why Amazon's a growth company, because they're still spending money on stuff that's new and it's still venturing out into a strange area that might have higher risks and might not. I mean,
anyway, there's a shift been reported, which happens from time to time historically, where the value side of the market for the last year has outperformed the growth side of the market. And historically, when these shifts occur, they last for some time. Again, and when we tend to follow this, academic studies again and again and again have pointed out that over the very long term, over decades, the value stocks as a group that are traded in the United States tend to outperform the growth stocks. For the last decade, that was a really bad bet for the short term.
All right.
But it seems to be reversing itself.
What we're trying to say here is there's and we said this in a very esoteric and scholarly sort of way. A major change just happened in the market. These are kind of cycles. And when we watch these cycles beginning, it's exciting for those of us that are nerdly minded. But this is the first episode of the year. And we skipped two episodes and played best of at the end of last year. So a lot has happened since we were live and in living color. A lot. We have a lot to talk about. We've got people asking questions as well. What were you going to say?
There's another big change that's taken place. And it took place at the same time in the market.
Okay.
A major shift has occurred in the market. And typically, as I was looking back, couldn't find any references to it, but I can see that it appears to be a normal event. When interest rates are falling over a long period of time, two things tend to occur. Growth stocks tend to outperform value stocks, And bonds act like they're stocks in a bull market. They keep rising because the more interest rates fall, the more the value of bonds in the secondary market, the market value of bonds rise. But when interest rates rise, the market value of bonds fall. We went through a period of falling interest rates from about 1982 until basically last year. And in the last 2 years, particularly, interest rates have turned around and started rising, and very specifically a lot last year. As a percentage from the starting point, we have seen the fastest rise in 1 year of interest rates in the United States that we've ever had. Now, if you count points, like if 1% to 2% is 1 point, you could say, well, they haven't risen that much. But if you count the fact that the difference between 1% and 2% is 100% gain, 100% change in interest rates, whoa, that's a big change. And that's what's happened in the last year. So we actually saw, and different indexes have different results here, but a somewhere between 13.5% and 15% fall in the value of bond indexes in the United States last year, which is another massive sea change. And this type of event historically seems to coincide with the reversal of growth stocks to value stocks. And there's a really good reason for that. Jake pointed it out. When people are borrowing money to increase earnings in a company, and the growth companies do that, if borrowing is cheap, if interest rates are 1% and 2%, they can borrow a lot of money to pump up their growth rates to market and to do all kinds of things. But when interest rates start back up again, it becomes more and more expensive to have that borrowed money on the books. As interest rates go up, growth companies' profitability tends to fall because in many cases, they have a lot of what's called leverage, which is borrowed money. And their borrowed money typically is float. In other words, the interest rates is short-term borrowing with floating interest rates. So it becomes more expensive for them to keep that borrowed money on the books, which lowers their profitability, which means their price of the stocks go down. It's a pretty interesting thing to dig into, but it's pretty complex. So the benchmark yield on the U.S. 10-year Treasury note fell to 3.55% from last week's 3.71. That's beautiful. Mainly for the same news that seems to cause stocks to rise, and we can talk about that. Basically, that the unemployment dropped to 3.5% and the wage growth has slowed down nicely. But we'll talk about that later in the show. Let's talk about the markets. The six-month T-bill, though, is yielding 4.79, with the 10-year Treasury note yielding 3.71, which means the yield curve is still inverted, which historically, in about 80 to 90% of the cases, has indicated a recession is coming, but it might not this time. So we got that. Now, this is what's interesting. Interest rates have risen 120% in the last 2 years. Get that. Interest rates are up 120%, causing bonds to generally to lose more market value in 2022 than any time since records have been kept, because bond values fall on the secondary market as interest rates rise. West Texas Intermediate crude oil fell over 8% to $73.76 per barrel. That should make a lot of people happy because it means the price of gasoline and diesel fuel and so on will be coming down in the not too far distant future. And why did it come down? Because the rest of the world is either in or sliding into recession pretty much, except the United States, which is something else we can talk about. Let's see here. That's the markets. I could talk about lots of other things, but that's the markets.
Okay. So what are
did we give our telephone, our not telephone, did our we give email our addresses? Email?
Nope. Yeah. If you want to join the conversation, you may email us, preferably both email addresses, jake@tpwc.com and jeff@tpwc.com. That's Tango, Papa, Whiskey Charlie, or The Personal Wealth Coach. Typically in a normal program, when we finish talking about what happened in the market during the week, we would jump into listener questions that have been waiting for us to answer. And we've got several good ones. But before I jump into that, I want to give a brief overview of the many topics that we may hit on today because they're new. The retirement package in the omnibus spending bill that's being referred to as Secure 2.0 about retirement ages and when required distributions occur and all kinds of other stuff, but more specifically, opening a window into the brains of Congress. So we'll talk a little bit about why it is that bills don't make any sense when they come out. Massive changes there. We have what is apparently a recession going on in Europe, China opening up on COVID and the illnesses going stratospheric, but also the exports picking up and the manufacturing picking up in China. All of these things are important. We're also going to be talking about the likelihood of recession and what that means and how we come up with this stuff. Where are we gathering this data that says whether or not we're going to have a recession and how fundamentally inaccurate it is or isn't? So we've got two questions. The first one I'm going to hand off to you. It is from Inquisitor John. Inquisitor John is our most faithful questioner. He questions us on everything. First question this week is, he's got, as is tradition, a picture that he's taken of the paper Wall Street Journal. The analog Wall Street Journal has been digitized and emailed to us with a question about an article. The question is, where and how are stockpiles maintained? And he's talking about a series of different raw material stockpiles. Raw material stockpile gets boost is the article's headline. So you want to go ahead and begin that?
Yeah. John, this is a more complex question than the newspaper article would suggest. The National Defense Stockpile that was started in 1939 at the beginning of World War II is run by the Defense Logistics Agency, which is a branch of defense that's neither the Army, Navy, Marines, or Air Force. It's under the Secretary of Defense.
And one quick interjection, not to be confused with the Strategic National Stockpile. There are about five different stockpiles with the word strategic and some version of national or defense in the title, because Congress has made more than one of them over the years. Okay, continue.
But the one you're asking about, the National Defense Stockpile, where is this stuff stored? Well, officially, according to the National Defense the Defense Logistics Agency, yes, which the National Defense Stockpile is part of. The National Defense Stockpile actually has only 100 employees, but it has 17 official storage sites across the United States, and there's probably more. And the answer is lots of places. It's based in Fort Belvoir. How much of it is stored in Fort Belvoir is open question. That's where their administration offices are. And I found several different references to the numbers of places that it's stored. It's stored in a lot of places, which is a really good idea. They don't store it all in one place. In the Army, we used to say one artillery round could take out all of you if you cluster together. So people would spread out for defense. And the stockpile is spreading out. And by the way, the newspaper article suggests that they're buying up a bunch of stuff, and they are. But they're also selling a bunch of stuff at any given moment. If the Congress or the Defense Department declares that they have excess whatever, they go into the market and sell it. And they are, in many cases, the largest supplier, in some cases, of rare and exotic materials used in electronics in the world, in some cases.
When we've talked about the national budget and spending and so on, quite often we talk about revenue from corporate income tax, and revenue from estate tax, and revenue from personal income taxes, and revenue from other. The revenue from other, most of these stockpiles are net profitable to the U.S. government, in that they're buying up when things are traditionally low-priced and selling them back to everyone else when they're really high-priced. So there is a net benefit here. There are stockpiles under the Defense Logistics Agency, the Department of Health and Human Services, and the Commerce Department. There may be others as well. So there's obviously stockpiles under defense that have nothing to do with raw materials for constructing defense items. So we have completed defense stuff in stockpiles too. So there's a lot of different, and they're all secret. And they're all everywhere. And you don't know what they are. They could just be a warehouse that's standing out there that doesn't have a logo on it. That's generally what they are.
And there's actually an the top of it above these stockpiles is the Directorate of Strategic Planning and Market Research. So I think that was cool. They have market research people. They have Directorate of Material Management, and it is a complicated bureaucracy that is theoretically continually looking for things we're short of, that including rare earths. Some of the rare earths they have are really rare, unlike most rare earths. So whenever something comes up, and they, by the way, this is one of the things they do with defense contracting, is when a defense contract is let to make a new fighter jet or a new tank or whatever, or an old one for that matter, the contractor has to identify critical things in the defense related object or thing that they're doing. They have to identify raw materials that are hard to get in the United States or can't be gotten in the United States. And they then, by law, automatically get included in the Defense Logistics Agency's directorate someplace. And so quietly, through third-party brokers, the Defense Logistics Agency goes out and quietly begins to accumulate these items that are not available in the United States so that they don't run the price up.
Cobalt and magnesium and lots and lots of things that we don't produce a lot of in the United States. Yeah.
So like aluminum, lithium alloy, beryllium, copper, master alloy,
yeah,
cadmium, zinc, telluride.
And a lot of times,
like someplace you'd go skiing, right?
And when purchasing in the United States during the pandemic, most purchases of things like that were secretly being made from our strategic reserves. So just hold that in mind. That's a functional part of our government. And I really don't, it's complicated, bureaucratic, and ultra secretive, but somehow it's working, which means I don't really want to open up the hood on that and stick my fingers in, because it could all stop working at once. I don't know.
Well, among the things they piled, and I think this is fun, you've probably never heard of this, hafnium.
Right. Yeah.
We have to have hafnium.
Okay. So moving on to the next question.
Okay. You don't want me to talk about indium?
Yeah. We could keep going on and on about every material held. That would make the most interesting program of the year, as we went through the entire catalog of the strategic reserves, item by item and amount by amount. How many troy ounces of unknowniums is it?
Rhenium. Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, I think it's fascinating. I didn't know this stuff existed. And I started looking at the stuff that we have. We don't have a lot of some of these things. And I thought, well, why don't we have a lot of it? And then I looked at the price per ounce of the stuff that they store and went,
that makes sense. Yeah.
If I would like to have a rhenium, whatever it's called, mine someplace, yeah, and that would be cool.
All right. The next question from John is one that covers a broader range than maybe he even knew. He's got an article from the Wall Street Journal again, and there's a whole section that's circled that's basically saying the 60-40 portfolio is in trouble. There is a change from growth to value going on right now. Think people should buy companies that are actually profitable. And both of us said, wow, this is brilliant. Obviously, it's brilliant because it agrees with us. So in the middle of that, it talks about something called inflation-linked paper. And inflation-linked paper, in the middle of all of this, what does that even mean? And that's his question. What is inflation-linked paper? And let me see if I can... I won't. It's a long quote, so I'm not going to read the whole thing. But it's basically what's going on in the world. Bonds are in turmoil, and inflation-linked paper is a big part of our life now. And he says, what is it? Well, It's a kind of loan. It's a kind of loan that is generally only done by institutions getting the loan that are absolutely massive. So if you go if you say, hey, I want to get a loan, and you feel like there's a lot of people willing to give you loans, but you want to make sure you have a good relationship with them over a long period of time, you may offer a little perk on some of the loans that you're getting, saying, hey, I'll link it to inflation, and I won't just pay you the normal interest. We're going to put that interest rate and float it on this algorithm that talks about inflation, whether it's the CPI or the core CPI. You make that decision when you're getting the loan. Well, that's an expensive way of doing a loan. It's expensive because you have to calculate inflation. So you have to have in the contract an agreed upon algorithm that you're following. This is what we're calling inflation. And then you have to keep up with it and make sure that the interest rate actually changes to match inflation as you're going along. And so that's, you know, when you, if you're talking about a treasury inflation protected security, that is a loan that it's tacking inflation on top of what's paid in the interest. If you're talking about an I-bond, we've talked about I-bonds as savings. That's got inflation tacked on it. It only changes its interest rate once or twice a year because it's expensive to follow those interest rates and figure them out. If you did it on an average daily balance, somebody would have to actively be managing each loan. And that gets expensive. That's why most companies don't issue inflation-protected securities, inflation bonds. Ford doesn't do it. Microsoft isn't doing it. They might at some point if we have a really easy way of managing that, but it's a layer of extra bureaucracy. And this is where I really want to go here. It's resting on a strange set of algorithms that most people have no clue about, but without them, the quality of the majority of our lives would be much worse. What am I talking about? Well, if you're on Social Security and you get a cost of living increase, how is that figured? Well, it's based on some bureaucrats in a building somewhere or multiple buildings that are looking at how much your potential rent value in a house you aren't actually renting out is. And we talk about bureaucrats and we give, you know, the Bureau of Economic Analysis and the Bureau of Labor Statistics a great deal of respect. We're missing a word in American English that I think we should have. And they have it in England. They have it across the UK. It's called boffin. We have a bunch of boffins in these bureaucracies that are absolutely brilliant people. Maybe not in all aspects of things they could be brilliant about, but in a very, very focused area that most people don't understand at all. But without this relatively few number of people who are just sitting around making measurements all day long, the amount of money you make per month would be different. It'd probably be lower. And this is another one of those things. Our lives get more complicated every day, and we get people that are specializing in career paths, and there's this complaint of nobody knows how electricians do their work anymore or how to plumb their house. And when I was a kid, we used to fix our own cars, and things are getting more and more complex. Now, the code that we follow for an electrician is more complex. The code that we follow for plumbing is more complex than it used to be. It's making it harder for an individual to do all the things. Think how hard it would be for an individual to figure out how much pay to increase based on inflation if you don't know what inflation is. Do you have to go and calculate that yourself? So we've got weirdnesses in our economy that have never existed in the history of humanity. We have people whose only job it is to measure the prices on things that they're not actually buying and have no intention of buying. And some of the things that they're measuring prices on don't actually exist. Like, what is the rental value of a house that's not being rented? We think it's this. So this is worthwhile to think about at the beginning of the year, that we have really weird, it's almost like a priesthood of money that's not really measuring the money. I mean, it's not really worshiping the mother money. It's just spending a lot of time watching it or thinking about what it does. And at the same time that we're doing that, our universities are building whole programs on this esoteric theory of watching things change in value and measuring it and trying to figure out how that works. And weirdly, we're getting better at it. We're getting better at this really complicated measurement process of who lives in this country. And that's cool. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about. It's coming up on time to play commercials. We want to talk about Secure 2.0 changes there. We want to talk about whether or not we're headed for a recession. We want to talk about the other things that are going on in the world and whether or not Turkey should be called Turkey or Turkey. Yes, that is an actual piece of news. And we'll be back after we play these commercials. If you'd like to join the conversation, our email address is in here. Our Jeff at tpwc.com and Jake at tpwc.com. That's Tango, Papa, Whiskey, Charlie, or the personal wealth coach. And we'll be back on the other side of these vitally important messages. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jake and
Jeff McClure.
We have lots to talk about. This is a lot.
We have lots to talk about.
Yeah. Do you think, well, let me bring up a subject that's not as dry as the changes in the retirement plans and so on. And something that I've been wanting to talk to you about anyway, about the possibility of recession in the coming 12 to 18 months. And what does that mean? What does it mean for the market? What does it mean for the economy? Or for more importantly, what about me? What about my job? What each of you listening, what does it mean to you? So first, before we talk about whether or not we'll have one, let's talk about what a recession is. Number one, the definition of a recession, well, there really isn't one, except that the Bureau of Economic Analysis and a series of others will INBER is a bureau that the National Bureau of Economic Research, I believe, is the one that says this is a recession or not. There's no classic definition. For a long time, we said two quarters, half a year of negative growth. That's contraction of going backwards, receding in the whole nation's economy would be considered a recession. Well, we've got all kinds of ways of measuring that now. The Great Recession had a quarter of shrinkage followed by a quarter of growth followed by two quarters of shrinkage. But in the middle of that middle quarter of growth is when we declared a recession. So the definition has been changing on what a recession is. But long-term, recessions are normal. For the last 50 years, if you don't count the last 10 years, so the first 40 years of the last 50, we had a recession about every 4 years. Pretty normal. Got 3 years of growth, 1 year where we had a recession. 3 years of growth, 1 year where we had a recession. That's a normal growing economy. As an economy starts to reach maturity, it has fewer recessions usually, but they tend to be more severe. So the big question is, how much are we growing? We've had a big, big recession called the Great Recession, 2007-2008. And that's what most of us think of when we think about recession. There's a lot of adults that are in the marketplace, in the economy, that's the only recession that they even know about, rather than this 50-year cycle of, you know, really normal recessions. So a recession doesn't have to be a horrible thing. It can just be a slow stagnation for a little bit while we figure things out, or it can be really, really traumatic. How can you tell when a recession's coming? Well, we talked before the break about the data that you gather and the boffins that are, you know, just measuring things. We've got leading economic indicators. There's an index of them that have been down for 9 months in a row that's shouting for a recession. Now, and this may simply be because the interest rates have risen so fast, but that's kind of irrelevant. You and I, old Baldy and younger Baldy, older Baldy, younger Baldy, have talked about how consumers seem to keep spending. And that's driving the economy. We keep spending money. We're spending money faster than we're making money, actually. But we have a lot of savings, so that's okay. We're not racking up the debt at high rates to make this spending spree continue. We're still spending, we're still hiring, and there's still a lot of cash on hand. One of the things that we're measuring when we make these references of whether or not we think there's a recession coming is we're looking at how much money do people have in savings, how fast are they spending it, and how much did they have before they had the big bulk up in savings? So there's a behavioral thing. If people are spending their savings fast, if you have $5,000 in savings last year and you get $8,000 in savings this year, you're going to feel great, but you'll feel bad if you go back to $5,000. You feel like you've moved backwards, and so you're going to slow down spending probably faster than you slowed down last year when you had $5,000. That may have been more than you had the year before. So if you start dropping the amount of money you have in the bank, at some point, people stop spending. And this is I've just peeled apart all the other pieces. How quickly are people going to slow down in their spending is the question people are asking when they say, is there going to be a recession? And it's as easy to comprehend if we say in the next 18 months, no, I don't think so. The weather can change that outlook. So this isn't even as good as trying to give an overall outlook on the weather. Weather reports are notoriously wrong, but they're getting more and more accurate. The weather report fits into the economic report. When we have big storms in the first quarter of the year, the winter, this is where we are now, that makes a big impact on the economy for the whole year. So if we have 8 or 9 massive bomb cyclones in the Northeast, we're going to be in a recession. So how do we make a prediction, or anybody make a prediction and then feel proud of our prediction when so much of the stuff is random? All we can make our predictions is how fast are people spending money, how fast are people getting jobs, how many people are getting laid off. There's a lot of variables that we absolutely don't know and have no control over when we make these predictions. Now, having laid that all out, what is your outlook, Elder Baldy, on whether or not we're going to be in a recession in the next 18 months?
18 months is a little long. I think the probabilities of us actually entering into a real recession, and by real recession, Jake alluded to this, but I think it's important to understand. Some of the things that are considered in GDP, just like some of the things that are considered in the consumer price index, from the perspective of normal people doing normal things in normal life, are silly. Yeah. Now, from a perspective of trying to measure the movement of a gigantic national economy, I'm sure to the economists who set them up, they make perfectly good sense. For example, we've said this many, many times. In the consumer price index, one of the largest items, one of the weightiest, most considered items, is the rental value of a house that somebody owns that they're not renting. In other words, if you live in a house and you own the house, whether you have a mortgage or not, one of the big things that is considered for the consumer price index is the potential rental value if you were to decide to rent your house. Whoa, what's that got to do with inflation?
And are you actually experiencing that in inflation at this moment?
No.
Well, no.
Just like when it comes to GDP, a sort of mythical number called the trade balance either subtracts to or adds to the GDP. If we have a negative trade balance, which we have had for about half a century now, for instance, it runs now about 3% of GDP, it subtracts 3% from the gross domestic product. So right now, and this is news, and I think it's amazing, Moody's is estimating, and they're probably the most prescient estimators of such things.
Yeah.
Moody's Analytics is estimating that the fourth quarter GDP will be 4.1%. So before I go any further, this is important to look at here.
That's a lot of growth.
It didn't mean we grew 4% in the fourth quarter. It means if that same growth rate continued for a year at exactly that rate, it'd be 4.1%. And that's, by the way, going to be an estimate when it comes out, and it'll be a year before we know how much we actually grew in the fourth quarter, which makes the whole thing sort of silly.
And you might say, well, just divide it by four, but it's not exactly that number either. That's a good reference, but it's not exactly a fourth division. So
it becomes sort of weird. Last quarter's was 3.2. So you asked me, do I think we're going to have a recession? We are experiencing right now accelerating gross domestic product growth in the United States. It's really hard, and we have just had a huge number, 200 and some thousand people got hired. 223,000 new jobs in December, in the month of December.
Right.
There were 223,000 at the employees. Now, this is seasonally adjusted, so they've taken into account seasonal workers for Christmas. 223,000 more people were employed at the end of December than were employed at the beginning of December in the United States.
All the tech layoffs that you read about.
Right. I'll tell you what, employers who do the hiring and the firing and the layoffs and so on have a much better feel for where the economy is going than does the government.
Yeah.
And they are saying we are not going into a recession.
And I agree. That is what they're saying and what they're at. Now, what's fueling that growth? When we look at income growth, it's not growing as fast as spending growth. So where is it coming from?
Money.
It's coming from money sitting in banks. So when we money's sitting somewhere. Money market funds, banks, cash equivalents. It's sitting out there and it's being spent down. And we're watching that number, that big bulge that we acquired when everybody had nothing to spend the money on. You couldn't go to the gym or the movie theater or the restaurant and we had stimulus money given. So our bank accounts got big, and they got to a historically record large amount. You can't find a time in history when we were saving as much as we did during that time period, even during the wars, the big ones. So we have this big savings rate, and people continued to get paid during that time period because of the different stimuluses. Okay, as we spend that money down, at what point are people going to put on the brakes on the spending as that money is going down? And that's the question. So when we're hiring, it's based on this extra spending that's coming in. But if that extra spending stops, that's the point. That's where we would say this is when people are going to turn around and not be hiring.
We're almost out of time, but I want to say what would cause the extra spending to stop.
Right.
If people saw deflation begin to take place, this is when people stop spending, and they think they'll save money by waiting to buy something, then the extra spending would stop.
Right. And when we get back down to a level that feels uncomfortable when you look at the bank balance, and that's a behavioral question. Nobody knows when that point will be. People will stop spending their money once their bank account balances and their money market balances get low enough.
And their credit card rates positions get higher.
Right. And all things being equal, that's somewhere in September of 2023. So just be aware of that out there.
Whoa.
So we got to wrap up for this hour and go to next hour because we've got more to talk about on that subject. Hopefully this is enough to leave a cliffhanger. If you'd like to talk to us off the air, we do give individualized custom fiduciary investment advice and portfolio management. The phone number for our office locally is
254-947-1111
or 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com, contact us through the contact form or email us through jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can listen to podcasts and so on. Until next hour, this is The Personal Wealth Coach.